Hi, I'm Simon Phipps. I'm standing in for Randall Schwartz presenting Floss Weekly. This week, I'll be with Jonathan Bennett as my co-host, and we'll be interviewing Garrett Damore about the NanoMessage project. That's a library for handling MQ messages over the internet. It's techie, it's geeky. We'll be talking about Illumos as well, and you don't want to miss it.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Simon Phipps and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 469, recorded January 31st, 2018. NanoMessage.
Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, a new podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit redhat.com/commandlineheroes.
Hi, welcome to Floss Weekly. I'm Simon Phipps, standing in for Randall Schwartz, who's out cruising the Caribbean at the moment. And I'm delighted to say that I have a wonderful co-host this week in the form of Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan, welcome back to the show again.
Yes, it's just been forever since I've been able to be on Floss Weekly.
It's good to have you back. So this week, we're going to be talking about something called a NanoMessage, which seems to be an MQ program. Do you know anything about this?
So I know that it is another layer of not obfuscation, but it's a layer that sits on top of TCP and UDP in the same way that TCP and UDP is a layer that sits on top of the MAC address, the local link stuff, and it's another building block so that programmers can kind of forget about a bunch of those details down in the lower layers. Other than that, I'm not very familiar with it, but that's okay. We get to learn about it today.
Right. And this is also related to Illumos, I believe, which is what Open Solaris turned into. I was involved in that when I was at Sun. Do you have any insights into Illumos and how it's doing?
I am very familiar with Linux, which is a Unix-like operating system. But Illumos is an actual Unix operating system, which is kind of outside of my expertise as well. I know enough about it to be dangerous, which is kind of perfect for being the co-host on this show.
Well, that's enough jabbering. Before we bring on our guest, who is Garrett Damore, Leo, I think you've got a message for us here.
Hey, sorry to interrupt. Love Floss Weekly. Love the open source. And if you're a Floss Weekly listener, you probably know and maybe even love Red Hat. Did you know they have a new podcast? It's hot, too. It's climbing the charts, called Command Line Heroes. This is for you and all the Command Line Heroes out there. It's a brand new original podcast for geeks by geeks from Red Hat, hosted by the fabulous Saranyat Barak. She does such a good job and interviews, well, talks about stuff that you and I probably alone care about. The epic true tales of the developers, the programmers, the hackers, the geeks, the open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. What's a command line hero? You might be one if you've ever taken something apart to see how it works. Yes. You'd rather make something instead of just using it. Yes. Command line heroes are the makers, the builders, the dreamers, and the doers who are transforming tech and shaping our tomorrows. You might not know, but Saranyat Barak actually founded Code Newbie. She hosts two other tech podcasts. She lives and breathes open source. In fact, we got to get her on this show. Each episode goes deep on a topic you care about. For instance, the first season alone, brand new, covers the OS wars going back to the 80s, how Linux came to be, covering the desktop front and the battle for the data center. Future episodes will talk about the development of the Agile movement, the story of DevOps, those doing combat in the cloud. Here's how you get Command Line Heroes. Of course, you could just check your favorite podcast app or go to redhat.com/commandlineheroes. You can listen to the episodes there. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts. You can get it. Or, again, redhat.com/commandlineheroes. And there's extras there, show notes, and a lot more. redhat.com /command line heroes. That is. Now that sounds good. All right, back to the show we go. Thanks for letting me interrupt, guys.
It's no problem, Leo. That really does sound awesome. So with no further ado, let's bring on our guest, Garrett DeMore. Garrett, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Simon. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm glad to be here.
Now, of course, we know each other because we've both worked at Sun Microsystems. We've both been involved in Open Solaris. We've even both been involved in Illumos. Our listeners don't know anything about that. So could, perhaps you could introduce yourself and NanoMessage. Could you do that for me?
Right. Right. So, I mean, I have probably a little bit more notoriety from Illumos, but lately it's been more around this other project called NanoMessage. So, yeah, and we do have some shared history, don't we, Simon? NanoMessage is, if your listeners or viewers may be more familiar with another project called ZeroMQ. NanoMessage was a follow-on project in an attempt to create something like ZeroMQ, but learning from the lessons. You know, every time we go and write a project, I think every developer goes through this. They make something and then they learn a lot, and then they want to do it. They want to do it over. Well, Martin, the original author of ZeroMQ, did that with NanoMessage. And what NanoMessage is for lack of a better term, it's a messaging substrate that helps create a lot of simple patterns that come up over and over and over again in solving messaging problems and distributed computing problems.
Right, right. And the NanoMessage was forked from ZeroMQ, is that correct?
That's not quite really. I mean, a fork would imply a shared ancestry in terms of actual code. There's a shared ancestry in terms of ideology and even authorship, but the actual code, there's no common code. For example, ZeroMQ is completely written in C++ and carries a GPL-ish license. I don't remember whether it's LGPL3 or that's ZeroMQ. NanoMessage was written in C with a completely different set of internals and a more liberal license.
Right. So this was more of a community fork, a group of people deciding that ZeroMQ wasn't their future and they needed to develop something else?
Well, I think what Martin wanted to do was he wanted to be able to use the something like ZeroMQ in some different scenarios where the combination – and I know this is how I was drawn to NanoMessage – was I had experience with ZeroMQ and I wanted to be able to use something like that in contexts where C++ was not appropriate or contexts where actually the licensing was challenging. Particularly, you know, even mixing with other open source licenses, there's a stickly surface of compatibility around GPL, and never mind, you know, proprietary projects. And I had a startup where I was working on some proprietary code, and I needed something like this. And NanoMessage really appealed to me. And my background here was that I joined wanting also to build a cloud orchestration layer. We didn't call it that back then. But I was also wanted to do it on Illumos, and I wanted to use Go. And at the time, Go wasn't C-Go support wasn't available on Illumos. So I needed a pure Go implementation. So I wound up writing an alternate implementation of the same protocols that are a NanoMessage called Mangos, and that's how I got started in the whole thing. Right.
Now, I've been reading around NanoMessage, and my late friend Peter Hinchins wrote about it in 2016, I think. And it didn't sound like the things were going very well in the NanoMessage project. In fact, I ran into an article that was called NanoMessage Postmortem and Other Stories by Drew Crawford. So it sounds like there's some stuff in there that we ought to kind of get out in the open. I also happened to read that you were the adult in the room while that was going on. So tell me all about it.
So, well, I mean, there was Drew first off was a participant in the NanoMessage community, and Martin had kind of, I think he'd gotten busy and to some extent lost interest in continuing to maintain NanoMessage. And then there were a lot of different competing ideas. And then you throw in the fact that the NanoMessage code base, Martin, we could talk a little bit about this. The code was ingenious, and the internal design is all state machine based. It's quite clever, but it's actually a little bit too clever because it's really hard to work in. It's a very challenging code base to sustain, just because you had to understand Martin's brain at the time. It's not that it's the code is necessarily poorly written or anything. It's very well written, but it's very challenging to get through. And anyway, I wound up sort of getting thrust into I don't know whether it was involuntary, but I certainly didn't intend to take on ownership of the project. And there was some hiccups in the community, and I stepped away from it for a little while to sort of see what the community would do, and maybe give somebody else a chance to step up. Nobody else did.
Right.
And I had my own projects, Mangos, which actually is a wire compatible with NanoMessage, was quite popular, and I wanted to continue sustaining that and using that. And at the same time, I had some ideas around some future directions that I'd like to do that would actually represent sort of a rewrite, a third generation, if you will, of these protocols. And so I stepped back up. And I basically kind of said, well, here's the situation. You know, I want to take this. I want to build something great. And that, you know, to do that, I actually need this project to be sensibly led. So a lot of that happened after Drew sent his post. So the postmortem, let's say the death of, the death announcement of Illumos of NanoMessage was a little premature. NanoMessage is alive and well and healthy, and people are doing some really, really cool stuff with it.
Right. And you're now working on a next generation, another rewrite called NNG, I believe.
NNG is a rewrite, basically, again, wire compatible, C, liberally licensed, but with a slightly different, actually significantly different philosophical approach to the core code. It started with, you know, being the inspiration coming from Mangos, because I was able to do a lot of really cool things in Mangos that it was just really hard to extend NanoMessage because of those internal state machines. NanoMessage is one set of state machines feeding into another set, and trying to follow those flows and architect around that was just really, really difficult. So NNG is designed to be a lot more extensible and to support some other activities. So, for example, we have a full implementation of WebSocket that's not just a toy. In fact, you can have a server listening on multiple ports. You can serve up files. We have another transport that speaks something called Zero Tier, which is actually a really cool global VLAN was probably the way, a secure worldwide VLAN. But we can use that as a low-level transport for NNG, and then gateway through NNG to legacy protocols like, you know, the TCP implementation of NanoMessage. So all these things can talk to each other.
Okay. So we've got four things here. We've got ZeroMQ, which is an LGPL genericized socket layer. We've got NanoMessage, which is message queuing layer, which is we've got NanoMessage, which is a rewrite of that is licensed under a liberal license by some of the members of the same community. We then had a hiatus. We've now got NNG, which is another rewrite of the same protocols. Does that kind of sum up
There's another one, which is Mangos, which is the Go implementation. And there's another guy that's put together a Rust implementation. So when I say implementation, I'm not talking about just linking and providing language bindings. I'm talking about a ground-up rewrite. But the difference is that NanoMessage, NNG, Mangos, and this Rust thing are all wire compatible with each other. That means they can all talk to each other. They're, right, if you will, just different implementations of the same set of RFCs, which we have. They're not IETF RFCs, but they are documents that describe the protocols that that NanoMessage is built upon.
So this is all wire compatible protocol stuff. There's you've not been re-implementing the same APIs, but it's rather been about a re-implementations of the protocol so that there are a variety of service libraries or clients.
That's correct. And in the case of NNG, we actually do have a compatible API. So if you have a – in fact, it's even binary compatible. So you could take an application that was built against NanoMessage and run it with NNG. You won't be able to access all of the additional capabilities because NNG does have quite a broad set of additional capabilities that legacy NanoMessage doesn't. But at least as a gateway step to be able to take your application and just start using NNG, you can do that right now. Now, I have to also interject that NNG is kind of pre-release, if you will. I don't recommend it in production use yet, although it's getting very close to that point. In the meantime, I am continuing to maintain and sustain the legacy libnanomessage.
Hey, Garrett, I wanted to jump in, if I could, with a couple of questions. So just to make sure we understand this correctly, is the old 0MQ, is it wire compatible, or what is it? Is the protocol itself compatible with this new set of programs?
No. When Martin, who was the author, the original author of both NanoMessage and 0MQ, when Martin started the NanoMessage project, he started with a different set of constraints, and he did actually implement quite different wire protocols. And 0MQ's wire protocols have evolved considerably over the years as well. I don't even think 0MQ is compatible with earlier versions of itself. It's a somewhat different set of circumstances than we have with NanoMessage.
Okay. But everything since 0MQ, so NanoMessage and then the NNG rewrite and all of the other children that exist, in the state they're at now, you can kind of mix and match. You can say, this program is already integrated with this.
That's exactly right. That was a core fundamental goal was to be able to do that because, for example, if I have a Go application, I mean, a good example of this is I might have a C program that needed to use legacy NanoMessage and provide, for example, access to low-level system features like maybe ZFS capabilities, right? File system capabilities, file system management capabilities. So I could express an RPC over NanoMessage with that, but I could have my business logic all written in Go and use Mangos and not actually have to have any C code in my Go project, but still talk over the same, you know, they can talk to the low-level sort of microservices stuff that I built in C using legacy lib NanoMessage.
So where exactly does, just so we know what we're talking about, where does this fit in the networking stack? Is this just another layer of abstraction over TCP WebSockets?
It is. I'm refreshing my memory with the old networking layers, right? So you had the network layer, and then you might have the presentation and session layers in there somehow. And I think it fits somewhere in there. It's between the application and the network layer. Traditionally, a presentation layer, I think, would also provide like XDR data representation capabilities. We don't do that. We're agnostic about that. But what we do is offer some additional capabilities so that application developers, they can use a socket-like API, but they send a request with an RPC, and if the remote site doesn't answer, there's an automatic retry built in. Same thing for PubSub. They don't have to worry about managing all of the TCP connection stuff because we just handle that under the hood. They just get like a rewrite, you know, or send receive API. In fact, NanoMessage is inspired by and tries to be similar to the BSD socket API, but provides all these additional semantics behind the hood, behind the covers, under the covers.
Okay. And then you mentioned WebSockets, which is an interesting idea. You know, that's kind of sockets for web browsers mainly. So is this something that is feasible to use a NanoMessage or a NNG to be able to talk to something running maybe JavaScript in a web browser?
Absolutely. That's actually the reason for the WebSocket. We call them transports. So we have transports. Mm-hmm. So we have a TCP transport, a TLS transport, a WebSocket, and WebSocket with TLS transport. And there's a Unix domain socket we call IPC transport and an improc transport. And there's some others that are in development and some that have actually already been created. But the WebSocket, the idea is, and with NNG, this is actually one of the cool things you can do, is you can have your web server, fire up this web server and serve up a Java applet or JavaScript applet that, an applet's probably the wrong terminology. I'm not really a JavaScript browser person, but a JavaScript script that runs in your browser, right? That can communicate to a backend service over using NanoMessage, which is, or NanoMessage, technically the underlying protocols are called scalability protocols, SP. Most people don't know that name. Everybody thinks NanoMessage because that's the product name.
So is there a NanoMessage or NNG implementation in JavaScript?
No, unfortunately, well, I say that. There is a Node.js capable version, which is really just binding the existing one. The protocols themselves are simple enough that for a couple of the patterns, people have implemented just basic send receive functionality enough to be able to speak to the backend NanoMessage protocols. Or NanoMessage services, but they generally, and I really would like to see this as something that somebody would develop, something that actually expressed the full semantics of the scalability protocols of NanoMessage in a JavaScript library. I may do that at some point, but I'm by no means is JavaScript my forte. As Simon knows, I'm kind of more a kernel and hacking down at C sort of stuff.
is the NanoMessage protocol all the things that it would have to do? Is that lightweight enough that would even work in JavaScript? JavaScript is not known as the fastest language, as compared to something like C.
Yeah, it should be fine. I mean, in terms of just sending messages, the actual overhead of doing this work is quite light. The heavy lifting stuff, if you will, is the WebSocket implementation itself, which isn't implemented in JavaScript. That's implemented by the browser. And we could talk about the insanity that is WebSocket. When you start actually implementing the RFCs, you really think, what the heck were these people thinking when they wrote this stuff? But the JavaScript doesn't have to worry about that. All it has to do is get the semantics. Now, what's different about JavaScript is that because of its event loop sort of architecture, you really do want a library that provides the sort of right glue in terms of semantics between the NanoMessage semantics and semantics that make sense in a page, in a web page, and in that sort of event-driven architecture that is the JavaScript environment.
So what's the adoption of NanoMessage been? Has, for instance, something like SaltStack, have they moved over to using the new NanoMessage code?
So I don't necessarily know everyone who's using NanoMessage. It's one of the things that we could be better at monitoring, to be honest. I'm not aware of any of the large open source projects that have adopted it. And part of that is because that NanoMessage was up until, I want to say just probably about 6 months ago. I'd have to go back and check the logs. But we had said that it was a beta product, right? It's no longer beta. It's solid. And the new NNG stuff is really pushing forward. Having said that, there are some really cool in production uses of it. But most of this is actually in proprietary projects. And part of that, I believe, is because the liberal licensing lets people do that. So, for example, there's a European company that uses it to control the robots used in, for example, sort of the full-scale airline simulations. When I say airline simulations, they have a big piece of an Airbus airplane or something on hydraulic jacks that moves around. But all of this is done between the controller and control computers that actually move it, as well to back to the central, if you will, computer service that figures out which servos need to move when and so forth. All that's done in NanoMessage. And the reason that it was given to me that was done was that NanoMessage was the thing that let them get the low latencies that they needed to be able to have that, you know, these fine and some of the fine grade robotics that they're using as well. So there are some really interesting use cases. But in terms of broad adoption, I think ZeroMQ certainly has the mind share there behind it. Part of that is just being a more mature project. But we're definitely seeing adoption pick up. And I think that when NNG matures, you know, reaches kind of a production readiness state, the additional capabilities that it offers, which actually go far beyond either legacy NanoMessage or ZeroMQ, are going to really we're going to see a lot more pickup there. Having said that, Mangos, independent of NanoMessage, has gotten quite a broad adoption in the Golang community. Surprisingly, a lot of people are just using that, and they never even heard about NanoMessage. But the networking capabilities of Mangos were attractive for solving problems with Golang projects, mostly cloud orchestration.
Sure. I did also want to ask, have you started to see NNG kind of cannibalize your existing your existing install base? Have people started moving to that in mass at all?
No, because I've discouraged it to a certain extent. And what I've asked people to do is, as folks are willing to try it, because I was pretty focused on just getting the functionality there. And the documentation is an area that where NNG just is missing most of the documentation. So right now I'm drawing near the end of the hardcore development cycle, and we'll be moving into pushing both the documentation and verifying the performance. Having said that, we had a community member do some performance runs, and it surprised me because we outperformed legacy lib NanoMessage. And I know that I haven't tuned NNG yet, but we're already beating. And I think that really has to do with the fundamental internal architecture being substantially different. We're already beating legacy NanoMessage on both latency and throughput, and I know we'll beat it on scalability, hands down.
Right. So I'm interested to know, Garrett, what are the relative user bases like on ZeroMQ, NanoMessage, and NNG? Is it orders of magnitude or what?
Well, my guess is that ZeroMQ, because of its huge it's very widely used. It's been around for a really, mm-hmm. really, really long time. I say that, I mean, not Linux timeframes, but, you know, 5 years in our industry is forever, and ZeroMQ. I actually don't remember when it was created, but I think it's got to be about a decade old now, which is forever, right?
Gosh, really.
So I think that ZeroMQ probably has at least one, maybe even two orders of magnitude more users than NanoMessage. But having said that, again, a big part of this is, you know, we don't really know who uses these projects. They get used, picked up in a lot of interesting and surprising proprietary projects. We do see some of it, you know, in the mail list. So we have, we have an active mail list, and there, you know, and we have certain community members like you've seen in other open source communities that are very vocal and active participants. But then we also see that there's a lot of lurkers, and I know that I know that about the lurkers because I can see the size of the list membership. So whether that's, you know, trying to extract from that, you know, the equivalent usage rates, you know, daily active users if you were a mobile app developer, I just, that hasn't been interesting to me. There's enough interest and activity to keep funding the project, and so the project moves forward.
Right. And when you mentioned their funding, you know, how is all this funded? Is this all held up by art, or is it contract revenue, or is there a company involved somewhere?
So, well, most of the development, the vast majority of it, has been sponsored through contracts to my consultancy. Having said that, there's been some signs of other people working on this project or wanting to invest in this project. So NanoMessage itself there's actually, over the long period of time, there's been quite a number of commercial contributors to it. And I've also done work on this project as an employee of other companies in the past. So when I was at Lucero, we built cloud orchestration around both Mangos and NanoMessage. And I know that I see commercial uses of both of those. But for the most part, most of the development is it's kind of a one-man show, and I want to change that. But there's enough work coming in to pay me to keep that project going, and it's been thriving quite well. So most of that is sponsored from a Dutch company called Capitar. They've been very generous with the sponsorship around NanoMessage, for which I'm very thankful.
Right. In the discussion that Peter Hinchins was making back about the history of NanoMessage, I think the main distinction he was making was that ZeroMQ was copylefted and NanoMessage was MIT licensed. And he felt that wasn't good for the sustainability of the project. He felt that led to work going on in secret. I suspect you don't feel that way. I suspect that you feel that the MIT license is a strength.
I do. I really do. You know, I've commented on this in the past on my blog and whatnot. You know, and I've contributed software over the years under a lot of different licenses. The problem I have with most of the copyleft, now the LGPL doesn't suffer from this as badly as some of the others do, but or rather as the core GPL does. But in some ways, it can restrict how you intermix software, even multiple pieces of free software that wind up having incompatible licenses, never mind proprietary stuff. And I see a lot of places where I or people I know haven't been able to use a project because of the copyleft restrictions. And it may not be that they're actually actively developing and extending the project, just being able to use it. So I don't really have problems with restrictions on further development, but when the restrictions actually restrict use and limit use of the project, that starts to make for a project that is substrate. You know, I'm not an app developer, I'm a substrate developer. You know, my interest is in having my substrate be as widely adopted as possible and widely usable as possible. So licenses that might restrict that are, at least to my mind, somewhat counterproductive.
Right. So one of the questions that's coming from one of the lists I'm looking at here is, how easy is it to switch from ZeroMQ to NanoMessage? Is that an easy port, or is that a whole lot of rethinking that one has to do?
It's a fairly straightforward port. There are differences in the APIs. And in fact, NNG's API is probably going to be a little bit more similar, more familiar to people coming at this from ZeroMQ, primarily because, the BSD socket API, while familiar to a lot of people, is actually, it's really hard to express some of the semantics sensibly with those. You know, the classic case of this is the C message, the extended message. How do you pass additional information with a message? You know, POSIX had reasons for why they had to come up with the obtuse method of doing that they did, because they didn't want to break a bunch of other APIs and applications. there was no reason for NanoMessage to do that other than it was what the example set by POSIX was. So it turns out to be really awkward. Zerum Q didn't do that. They have a completely object-oriented sort of approach to the whole thing. And NNG has a similar approach, albeit in C, where we just provide the most sensible and easy-to-use API that you could come up with. Certainly philosophically and ideologically, the projects have similar approaches to, at least at a technical level, how they present themselves and what kinds of problems you would solve. So you can usually find, if you have a pattern that you're solving in Zerum Q, you can usually find a one-to-one analog for that pattern with NanoMessage pretty easily, and it's a pretty straightforward port or adaptation.
Hey, I wanted to jump in, if I can, and ask this. What is the coolest application you've seen someone make of NanoMessage? Any kind of weird off-the-wall stories that just fascinating?
Well, the coolest one was that aircraft simulator. When I watched, you got to understand, this is a whole big body of an Airbus jet, and there's people inside, and they use this for flight crew training, right? So they can simulate what the aircraft feels like when, turbulence or something more severe happens. But that whole system is the glue for between all the components is all built on a substrate around that with NanoMessage at it. I won't say it's bottom layer, but it's close to the bottom layer, right? Of course, there's stuff below that, TCP and Ethernet and all that other stuff. But there's some other we've done some interesting things around high-frequency trading, which you wouldn't think NanoMessage would be a great or anything like this would be a great solution for. But it turns out that the latencies are good enough that, so there's actually tiers of high-frequency trading. Like the guys who put stuff on ASICs, that stuff is nuts, by the way, because how you can bankrupt a billion-dollar company in under a minute. You could do this with an ASIC approach, but for a lot of the currency traders, we saw they had latency tolerations that were well within what we could get for NanoMessage. They'd like to get under a millisecond. They want to be measuring latencies in microseconds. And that's achievable with NanoMessage with the right substrate.
Okay, so you said something very interesting there. You referred to NanoMessage as the bottom layer, and then you said, no, that's not accurate. But for an app developer, isn't the beauty of this that in their code and as far as they have to care about, NanoMessage essentially becomes the bottom layer?
Yes, they get to treat it as the bottom layer, right? That is the beauty, right? They're freed from having to worry about handling TCP connections and retries and, addressing and all this other stuff, right? I mean, a NanoMessage address is just a URL. Things get a lot simpler for them. And that's really what the intention of these projects is to make it easier to build networking or distributed applications, with PubSub or request reply like an RPC. We've got a surveyor pattern for service discovery and voting algorithms and so forth. So you can build those kinds of things, which are real common recurring patterns, really easily on top of NanoMessage or one of these other implementations, or frankly, easily on Zerum Q as well. I mean, that was the idea behind these things is let's make a common library of the most useful networking patterns and save people from having to reinvent the wheel every freaking time. And I think in that regard, all these projects have been very successful. There's some interesting bad blood between ZeroMQ and NNG. Maybe bad blood is too strong a word. I'm much less emotional about any of this. I think there is a set of problems that Zerum Q is very good at solving, and a substantial overlap with NNG and NanoMessage. All these things really come down to just using the right tool for the right job.
So that segues very well into something else I wanted to ask. We referred to it as perhaps a community fork or this parting of the ways. Are there any specific lessons that you've learned there that you think would be useful for other people in open source?
Well, yeah, certainly one of the things, circumstances that Drew Crawford wrote about, I think in some ways, and I should have learned this from Lumos as well, there were mistakes made really around trying too hard or putting too much of value on consensus. Consensus-based decision-making is really challenging, and it can lead to lack of progress, indecision paralysis. So especially as a project is small, until you have enough people to build a sort of a core leadership community that's large enough to run it in more of a consensus mode or more of a sort of a group leadership, strong leadership is important. And that was, when I took back over the NanoMessage project, that was something I basically said. I said, okay, well, if I'm going to do this, then I've got to come in as a strong leader, a benevolent dictator for life, if you will, so that I could see that the project was moving forward and not stymied by different ideas in the peanut gallery. The beauty of these licenses is if people don't agree with you, they have the freedom to fork. Forking is not a bad thing. It's a good thing, right? It's a sign that the technology is interesting and that you have enough people and parties to have a vibrant community. So that would be my way I'd look at it.
Sure. Hey, we have a question from the chat room. We do have a live chat. And Emily the Strange wants to know, does this work with things like SIP or IMS? Does it use WebRTC? What would it look like to try to use those things together?
Well, SIP is its own thing, right? In terms of you could potentially build a transport using one of these things, but it really is sort of orthogonal. I don't think it would make a lot of sense to run, for example, I have to be careful with WebRTC because of the environments that is involved with, in particular, the constraints around browsers. There might be some applications where it would make sense to use WebRTC as a transport for the NanoMessage protocols. But for the most part, I would say that these are orthogonal things. Where you would use SIP, you're using it to, for example, typically around VoIP applications, right? You probably wouldn't be using NanoMessage at the same time, although you might use NanoMessage for command and control of things that you can't easily express in SIP or where you don't already have libraries that are SIP based to do those things. So.
Okay. So I want to transition to talking about Illumos, which I know is something else that you're involved in and pretty well known for. And I before the show today, I'd never heard of Illumos. And I did a little bit of research and I found out that Illumos is closely related to Open Indiana. What is Illumos and what does it have to do with Open Indiana? And what is your involvement in all of that?
Okay, so Illumos was and it started life as under another name called Freon, which really meant free ON, which would be OSNet, which is the core kernel. Now, coming from the Solaris, or rather Open Solaris, effort. At the time, I had recently left Oracle, Snorkel, to work at a company that was building, Nexanta was building storage solutions on top of Open Solaris. And I was concerned about the possibility that I didn't actually think it would occur, but that Oracle might stop developing Open Solaris. I was also concerned that we'd have we might want to be able to make contributions that Oracle wouldn't necessarily approve of back to Open Solaris, right? that we might want to have the ability to develop sort of a, if you will, a Fedora to Red Hat, back in the days when Fedora and Red Hat RHEL were different. So that was the concept. Now, Illumos is the kernel, and unlike Linux, where Linux you have just a kernel and you have a distribution on top of that, Illumos is the kernel plus, you know, and drivers plus a bunch of the what I'll call the base system. So it's more closer to like the NetBSD base than Linux in that sense. So it has libc, the shell, and you know the system management utilities for the system. But it doesn't include, for example, an X window display manager or browser or any of that stuff, right? It's really just the core system. And then on top of that, you build a distribution, which is what OpenSolaris and OpenIndiana are. OpenIndiana was basically a distribution of derived from OpenSolaris, built on top. In fact, originally it wasn't built on top of Illumos. They quickly did shift it to that. So they uses Illumos as its kernel and core base system, but then builds on top of that all the other stuff to provide a usable system. And there are other distributions. SmartOS, which you may be familiar with, is a fairly popular one for cloud. Again, cloud. I'd say it's sort of like a hypervisor, cloud hypervisor, but it's based on Illumos as well. There's another one called OmniOS that's also fairly popular. OmniOS lacks a GUI, but it's for server hosting. It's a little bit more familiar to people coming from a Linux or BSD background than SmartOS is. SmartOS is sort of more like ESXi. It's just a base system that you then build things, but you don't do it in a main hypervisor. Instead, you do it in guests in containers. So it's a container hosting system. But all that stuff is built on top of Illumos.
So did you come to – were you a Sun employee that came to Oracle, or were you an Oracle employee when they bought Sun, or did you come after that?
I was very much a Sun employee that was acquired by Oracle.
So there were quite a few people at Sun that saw the handwriting on the wall when they knew that Oracle had acquired the company that they worked for. So I assume that as soon as that became known, you guys started working towards what can we do to save OpenSolaris, right?
There may have been some thoughts on that. I mean, I was on the Solaris Architecture Committee, PSARC, at the time, and I could see some of the – I mean, frankly, it made sense to me that it always made sense that Sun or Oracle, neither one of them, should sort of abdicate the responsibility for maintaining their flagship product to the community. So the challenge then was to figure out how to balance all that. I think some people left because of the open source decisions that Oracle made. I left before the finality of those decisions were true, and I actually didn't think they would come to pass quite the way they did. In fact, I made some public announcements around that when I was announcing Illumos that said, well, I don't think Oracle's going to do this, but we get a little bit of insurance in case they do. A week or two later, they did. they closed the gate. So I had to eat my words. But at the same time, we'd solved the core problems that allowed Illumos to carry forward, which is primarily getting the filling in the gaps in libc, which is the mostly around the internationalization stuff, which is the work I did.
When
I left Oracle, it wasn't because of their open source strategy. It was because of a cultural disconnect, I would say. So Oracle operates at least they did operate very much on a need to know basis. If you didn't need to know, then you didn't know. And nobody was going to tell you. And the decision making was extremely hierarchical. Where Sun had a much more engineering centric sort of open open culture. Information was expected to flow freely up and down the chain and across, and the chains were, I think they were, the organization was flatter. It felt flatter at least. Mm-hmm. So I just didn't like the whole sort of compartmentalized knowledge. And I felt that it was just a less interesting engineering place to be as a result of that. So that's why I left.
So going back to Lumos, is it a distribution in and of itself? Is it possible to say download the Lumos ISO and run it on a desktop?
No, not quite. I always wanted us to get to kind of that point, not necessarily under the Lumos moniker, but to have sort of a reference-based distribution, which sort of like NetBSD does, or even FreeBSD. I really wanted us to achieve that level. The problem is that, one of Lumos's big challenges is that it has so many people interested in it that have very different agendas that sometimes moving forward on something like that can be quite difficult, because getting all the people who seemingly need to agree on something like that to do so is very, very challenging. And that goes back to that whole consensus-based decision making. I think this is one of the areas around Lumos where a stronger leadership team that was a little less mandate, carried less of a mandate to satisfy everyone, we might have been able to make a little bit more progress on some of these other things. Having said that, companies like Joyent have managed to do so under their own, as part of their distributions, and Lumos is still quite a very lively and actively developed system. So I consider it a success.
where is Lumos heading at the moment, would you say, Garrett? It seems to me to be that what used to be Open Solaris is now a great big Venn diagram with Lumos as the overlap of all the circles. Is that a good description, or do you think there's some other future for it?
I think that's not a bad description. Certainly SmartOS is very actively developed, Joyent invests heavily there. I guess I should say Samsung now, right? And Delphix is continuing to develop. Now, what's interesting is that Lumos is also sort of a development home for some technologies that have extended outside of Solaris. So you look at things like Dtrace and ZFS, which is now, they have an open ZFS project. But we have developers who are primarily or principally Linux or BSD developers, or in some cases even Windows developers, who now are coming to the Lumos community, if you will, by way of these technologies like ZFS and Dtrace. So I think that what I'd like to see is more of these sort of commercial contributors come in. A couple of them have left the ecosystem. OmniTI had a great project in OmniOS, and fortunately the community has picked up the mantle to carry it forward with OmniTI's blessing and indeed encouragement. But at the same time, no one's funding that necessarily directly. And there are companies that are building products, a number of them, are on top of Lumos, because Lumos is a very capable operating system. So it's a good one to build a system on top of. But they're fairly quiet in the community. And I really wish I could figure out how to encourage them to be a bit more more exuberant about Lumos.
Yeah.
I think that's an important part of our community health. So from a risks analysis, my fear around Lumos is that it looks less distributed in terms of its development than I think it really is.
Right. So one of the things we mooted back in the day was the idea of having an Illumos foundation as a some neutral ground for all those people to meet. Do you think that that is still part of the solution, or do you think that the future of Illumos is to be, as I say, a giant Venn diagram forever?
I think that the primary contributors to Illumos have a difficult enough time agreeing on things that are strictly technology, that trying to get them to agree on something as non-technologically related as, say, a foundation. You know, now we're talking about business and politics. Good luck. and, you know, I tried. I did. And because
you still own the trademark, I believe.
I do. I still hold the trademark. And as I've said
numerous
times, if an entity were to arise where I could pass that trademark off, because it's silly that I own it. I own it because I started the project. That's all. And I'm not even, you know, I'm not terrifically active in Illumos anymore. There are a lot of people who have spent a lot more time and energy investing in Illumos of themselves recently than I have. And I'm grateful that they're there, but It'd be nice to have a foundation that could own the trademark, and not just the trademark, but I'd like to see somewhere where we could run, you know, have companies that don't necessarily have developers on staff, but who are Illumos developers, but they use Illumos. If they could contribute back into the ecosystem some way, and we had a way to funnel that back out to community members who are developers, and there's a lot of hobbyists developing stuff, you know, sort of like Kickstarter campaigns, if you will, that could be run through a foundation. I think that would be really cool. I think it would it would spur some additional development.
Right. Well, maybe we should talk about that sometime, Garrett, because in the Document Foundation now, we're using a tender model. We have an engineering steering committee that asks for technical features, and then the foundation puts them out to tender rather than making grants to individual developers. And that's worked pretty well for us so far as a way of getting things done. So maybe we should talk about that, maybe at OSCON or something. Maybe you'll be over for that.
Yeah, I at the moment I don't have any conference travel plans, but yeah, we can still have a chat.
Well, we ought to wrap up here because it's been an hour now. We've been looking through these things. So that's all very fascinating. And I know that Randall is here in the our private chat room, getting very excited, saying that he wants to go start playing with NNG because he's been using ZeroMQ at one of his clients. So you may well have a new contributor popping up in there. I don't know. I do have a contractual duty to ask you about your favorite text editor. Do you have a preference?
Actually, shockingly, I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but I've been using Visual Studio Code lately.
Oh, Randall just died a little out there in Colombia.
That's it. Show's over. Bye.
That's it.
but you know, it's amazing. But lately, Microsoft products have actually gotten to be, well, they're putting a lot of their past behind them, I think. And they don't suck as bad as they used to.
So, and on that subject of things that suck, what is your favorite scripting language?
Scripting? Gosh. I guess when I script, I probably still write shell most of the time, but I try not to write. If I need to write a script, it's usually only a few lines. So, you know.
Yeah, my favorite scripting language is still 6800 assembler, I have to say. So, okay. Well, it's been great to have you on the show. Thank you very much for coming on. And we wish you all the best with Illumos and with NNG. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Simon and Jonathan. It's a pleasure being here.
So that's all interesting stuff. Jonathan, tell me, what do you think? Are you now a convert to the idea of using NNG? Are you going to be installing Illumos on your PCs?
I doubt I will be installing one of the derivatives of Illumos, although I may have to set something up in a VM just to play with it and say that I have some experience behind the keyboard on one of those Solaris derivatives, open Solaris derivatives. The nano message idea, it's interesting. You know, for something like this in the past, I would probably set up some sort of REST API that uses HTTP or HTTPS. So it's good to have another way to do it. And I'll have to go play with it at some point again, just to get the experience and understand more about how it works. But it definitely seems to between this project and ZeroMQ, they seem to fill an important niche as far as an open source project that allows this sort of very rapid messaging. And I think probably, though, as far as understanding what it's about, that comment that he made that this represents the bottom layer. And then he said, well, no, it really doesn't. But we dug into that. And for the app developer, it does. This can be the bottom layer that they have to care about. They don't have to dig into, TCP, yeah, UDP, and the rest of the networking stack. And that's huge. Well, really, that's what computing is based on, is this idea of layers of abstraction. Once you get one of the layers done, you don't have to care about anything below it. You can just keep moving upwards. And that, yeah, is that. Funnily enough, that's why we have scripting languages, and we're not still all doing our scripting in assembly code, as you mentioned.
Well, I remember I was working for IBM when they developed a thing called MQ series, which was really the first time I'd ever heard this idea of a piece of infrastructure that would look after the messaging for you and save you from having to dig into TCP/IP yourself. And so it's interesting to hear how there are several different approaches to putting the protocol on the wire. I really like the fact that there's different approaches to putting the protocol on the wire, and I can see how that would be useful.
Yeah, it's almost always a bad thing when there's only one way of doing something, because it stagnates. There's no pressure to make it better if there's just the one idea about how to do it. And so, community forks like this, sometimes there's hard feelings and sometimes people get annoyed by it, but it's an important part of the larger ecosystem growing. There's got to be that competition, that evolutionary pressure, if you will, for things to mm-hmm. keep improving and not stagnate.
Right. Well, we've used up most of our time. I ought to talk about the upcoming shows. Next week, we have Process Maker in the queue, and that'll be Brian Reale, I think it is, and then Scan Code. And then the week after that, we have the Pearl Foundation showing up, which is dramatic and wonderful. And the week after that, we have GitLab on the show, and those two I'm really looking forward to. Those are going to be quite interesting and special shows. And then the SUSE Linux project is back with Alan Clark on March 14th, and a complete change from that is Etsy's Viper Builder is on March 21st. So there's a real diversity of shows coming up in the queue over the next few weeks. If you want to get your project into the queue, if you visit twit.tv/floss, you'll find there is a link there to the schedule that's coming up, and also a link for you to submit your show to Randall for consideration. Really, you need to tell Randall the project and who the project lead who would be on the show is, and he can then follow up. He doesn't really just want technology suggestions. He wants to have you do the research for him in that regard. I'm going to be speaking at FOSDEM this coming weekend. I'm doing the opening keynote on Saturday morning, where I'm going to be talking about 20 years of open source. February the 3rd is actually the 20th anniversary of the open source movement. And so I'll be talking about the history and the trends that I see in open source. And then I'm also getting up to speed on a UK conference called OGCamp. If you're in Western Europe, I would love you to come along to OGCamp on August 18th in Sheffield in England. That's oggcamp.org. You can buy tickets now. You want to get in and buy tickets early because they are going to sell out. You'll find me on Twitter as Webmink, and you're going to find me all over the place as S-Phipps, Simon Phipps, and Webmink on Google Plus, if anyone still uses that, on IRC, I tend not to use Slack because that's proprietary, but you'll find me on Riot. And anything you want to tell us about, Jonathan?
Sure, I'll just plug that I am at JP_Bennett on Twitter. Come follow me there for mostly technology musings, although there the occasional political rant sneaks in. And then also just a quick plug about Cyphrodyne Inc. If you have outdated technology that still has to run and you need to keep it secure, we may be able to help with that. Hit me up. We can chat about it if anybody has a need like that.
Excellent. Well, I think we've actually got Randall back next week. I'm not sure about that, but I think there's a really good chance that he's going to be interviewing Process Maker. So I suggest that you don't miss that. But that is all. Thank you very much for being on the show, Jonathan. Thank you for listening or watching the show. And that's all from Floss Weekly.